This episode features discussion of kidnapping and the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of a child that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
11-year-old Sean Hornbeck guessed it was October or maybe November. He couldn't be sure anymore. He had been imprisoned in this run-down apartment for months, tied to a stained and putrid-smelling futon, his mouth duct-taped shut.
By the clock on the VCR, Sean could see that it was almost noon. The monster would be coming back any moment now. The monster always came home around lunchtime to give Sean food, but he came home for other reasons too.
Sean tried not to think about it.
He heard the front door unlock and creak open.
The monster was home.
Sean was terrified, but there was nothing he could do. He couldn't move. He couldn't even scream. He was trapped in a nightmare, and it would still be 4 years before he would finally wake up.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Sean Damien Hornbeck, an 11-year-old boy abducted and held captive just 60 miles from his home for nearly 4.5 years.
On October 6, 2002, Sean Hornbeck was abducted while riding his bicycle off Highway A, about 0.5 mile from his home in the town of Richwoods, Missouri. Sean was bound and gagged, then taken to a dirty ground floor apartment about 1 hour away in a suburb of St. Louis. It was there that Sean became a victim of repeated emotional, psychological, and sexual abuse for over 4 years.
In today's episode, we'll look at the events leading up to Sean's disappearance and some of the horrifying details of Sean's first month in captivity. Then we'll dig into the first few days of the years-long search for Sean by his parents, investigators, and the good townspeople of Richwoods, Missouri.
Next week, we'll delve into the strange evolution of the relationship between Sean and his captor, and discover how the abduction of the monster's next victim, Ben Ownby, brought the search for Sean to its conclusion.
There is little known about Michael Devlin, the monster who kept Sean Hornbeck hostage for over 4 years.
We do know that he was born in 1965 and was adopted into a large family as a child, raised with 3 brothers and 2 sisters.
He was friendly, but always somewhat of a social misfit. At the time he kidnapped Sean, he was working as a manager at Emo's Pizza in a suburb of St. Louis, where he also worked as a part-time funeral home employee.
He lived in a run-down apartment complex. His neighbors barely knew him, although they remember him being a stickler for the rules. He wouldn't hesitate to call a tow truck if someone parked in the wrong parking space downstairs.
Michael Devlin didn't seem like someone who would break the law, which only made it more shocking for his co-workers and neighbors to discover that the boy who had been living with Michael for years was not his son, but his prisoner. October 6th, 2002, was proving to be a beautiful, crisp, carefree Sunday in the small, former mining township of Richwoods, Missouri.
Richwoods was a typical small town. Everyone knew everyone. No one locked their doors at night. It was quaint and mundane in the best way possible.
But all good things must come to an end.
Like most 11-year-olds, Sean Hornbeck looked forward to Sunday mornings. His stepdad almost always woke him with sausage and eggs, then let him watch cartoons in the living room. But that morning, Craig Akers slept in. Exhausted from a particularly grueling week at work, he opted to break the breakfast ritual for a little extra sleep. Sean would just have to make do with a Pop-Tart.
Sean spent the morning lounging around the house, playing his favorite video games. There isn't much known about Sean Hornbeck's childhood, out of respect for his privacy, but we do know that he was a curious, fun-loving kid who loved his family and playing video games with friends.
Being the energetic boy that he was, Sean quickly grew bored that Sunday morning and asked his parents if he could go out and play. He really wanted to ride the new bike that his stepdad got him for his birthday over to a friend's house, most likely to his best friend, Patrick Reeves' house.
And naturally, his parents let him. Sean rode his bike over to Pat Reeves' house all the time. They just reminded him to be back by 5.
Sean left the house around 1 that afternoon, wearing his favorite bright orange Astros Little League jersey.
Sean's exact whereabouts throughout the day aren't exactly known, but he didn't go straight to Patrick's house. He was spotted around town multiple times by Richwood's residents, playing basketball at the local Lions Club and stopping in at the town grocery to get candy.
At around 4:30 that afternoon, Sean was spotted riding his bike down Highway A, a well-trafficked road that cut straight through town in the direction of his home. This was the last anybody saw of the boy for nearly 5 years.
Sean was about half a mile from his house on Highway A near Highway 47 when he heard a truck creeping slowly up the road behind him.
He didn't think anything of it. After all, Richwoods was a safe town. Cars passed down the local thoroughfare all the time. But this truck wouldn't pass Sean. In fact, it seemed to be following him.
Sean tried not to act nervous. He figured he was letting his imagination get the better of him.
The truck then came to a stop.
Sean relaxed a little, figuring maybe the person in the truck was just lost, would figure out where they were going and pass him soon enough.
But Sean was not that lucky.
The truck was moving again. It picked up speed. Sean dared to glance behind him and saw the truck was careening towards him.
Sean's heart pounded as he pedaled faster and faster, still hoping the truck would just pass him by, when suddenly...
his bike was struck from behind, sending Sean careening into a ditch.
As Sean lay in the ditch, his bike bent and broken beside him, a large man emerged from the truck and asked Sean if he was okay. He then helped the boy out of the ditch. Sean looked up at the behemoth of a man, 6'4 and just shy of 300 pounds, a towering giant compared to the small, helpless boy.
Sean gulped and tried to form words, but nothing came out. He wondered what had happened, whether the man had accidentally hit him with the truck, or why the man was now trying to help him.
Something was very wrong. Sean had never seen this man, and he knew everybody in Richwoods.
But before Sean could react, he felt himself hurled into the air as the giant man carried him over to the beat-up white truck. The man tossed him onto the truck bed. He landed on his belly, hard.
Sean winced as a large, heavy boot came down on his back. His arms were yanked together behind him and bound with duct tape. Sean tried to kick and scream as the man bound his feet, then finally covered his mouth with duct tape.
Though muffled, Sean continued to flail and scream, hoping that someone, anyone, would be able to hear him. This was the most populated highway in the area. Surely someone had to drive down the road and intervene.
Sean fought with all his might, straining his ears for the sounds of an oncoming car.
But he was met with silence. Nobody was coming.
This monster dragged the petrified boy to the passenger side of the truck, opened the door, and tossed him inside. But before shutting the door, he reached over Sean into the center console and removed a 9mm handgun.
With his sights trained on the boy, he racked around into the chamber.
Sean's eyes grew wide at the sight of the gun. He had seen guns thousands of times in video games. They were much scarier in real life.
The monster then leaned over Sean and said, You were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
In a moment, Mr. and Mrs. Akers realize Sean is missing.
Now back to the story.
Sean's mother, Pam Akers, watched the clock.
The seconds ticked by, then minutes. It was 5 o'clock on Sunday, October 6th, 2002. The table was being set by Sean's older sisters, Jackie and Jennifer. Sean's stepfather, Craig, had just come in from taking out the trash, and the family was about to sit down to eat. But not Pam. She couldn't eat yet. Her son, Sean, wasn't home.
Her eyes moved back and forth between the telephone and the clock. Sean promised he would be home by 5. She figured he would surely call if anything was wrong, but struggled to keep the doubt and worry off her face.
Craig assured his wife that Sean would surely be home any minute. After all, he had been late coming home before.
Pam nodded, but something felt different this time. Mother's intuition.
Dinner was now on the table, and Sean still was not home.
5:45 rolled around, then 6. At this point, the whole family began to worry. The sun had set, and Sean was scared of the dark. Pam turned to her husband and said, "Something is wrong with Sean."
Craig tried again to reassure his wife that everything was okay, that Sean probably just lost track of time and, when he realized it was getting dark, decided to stay the night at Patrick's house. But deep down, he too was growing concerned.
Pam called Patrick Reeves' house to see if he'd left for home yet. Her heart sank when Patrick told her he hadn't seen Sean that day.
It was 8 o'clock, and Sean was 3 hours late. Mr. and Mrs. Akers now knew that something terrible must have happened to their son. They then called the police and filed a missing persons report, but until daylight, there wasn't much more anyone could do.
By early Monday morning, October 7th, 2002, word had traveled around the small town. Washington County sheriff's deputies, police, and more than 100 volunteers on foot, ATVs, and horseback stood ready to comb through the rough terrain around Richwoods, Missouri, for any sign of the boy who had been missing for over 12 hours.
The mass of volunteers headed into the woods, calling for Sean, straining their ears for a faint call back.
They searched for hours, fanning the area, before finally making their way back to the meeting point. Sean's family was devastated.
According to a report from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, Sean's stepfather, Craig Akers, wearing the hand-painted shirt that Sean had given him the previous Christmas, joined the search on an ATV. He later wiped tears from his dust-covered cheeks when he came back empty-handed. Craig Akers has been the only father Sean had known.
Sean idolized Craig. He wanted to grow up to be a computer programmer like his stepfather, partly because of his love for computers, but largely because he loved Craig so much.
When Sean was just a baby, Craig took to the role of father like a duck to water. It was as if they shared the same bloodline. Sean had even walked his mother down the aisle and gave her away when she married Craig.
Christina Sauerwein stated in her book, Invisible Chains, quote, in fact, the Akers were in the midst of completing paperwork that would have allowed Craig to legally adopt Sean. The search continued all day to no avail. It took everything for Pam to keep it together. As dusk loomed, she knew they would have to call off the search.
Rich Woods is a heavily wooded area covered in old abandoned mine shafts. It was extremely dangerous to traverse at night.
But law enforcement officials were not deterred. They amassed a group of more than 200, including members of a volunteer motorized search and rescue team, to aid them in continuing the search throughout the night.
Earlier that day, search and rescue dogs did pick up Sean's faint scent near the intersection of Highways 47 and H, giving the Akers family their first glimmer of hope. Their boy was in the area just hours ago, so there was a chance he might still be close by.
With that lead, law enforcement officials hoped to at least find Sean's bicycle, an article of clothing, something. But no trace was found. It was as if Sean had just vanished.
Too restless and worried to sleep that night, Pam Akers stayed close to her phone just in case the authorities called with any news about her son.
To busy herself, she printed flyer after flyer with her son's picture. She could see no other way to stave off the terrible scenarios coursing through her mind, or where Sean might be, or whether he was still alive.
The next morning, Tuesday, October 8th, Pam wasted no time plastering the flyers all over town and in surrounding areas. She handed them out to anyone and everyone she met.
The whole town was in a frenzy that morning. Friends and family had shown up in droves to help hunt for Sean. Then hundreds of volunteers poured into the Richwoods area from all over the country.
Those who weren't already passing out flyers or actively searching for Sean were gathered at the Richwoods Volunteer Firehouse, a makeshift search headquarters helping the Washington County Sheriff's Department and Richwoods Fire Department any way they could.
The growing search party remained confident that they would find Sean. To everyone involved in the search, Sean was one of their own. There was a determined resolve amongst the volunteers. Nobody was leaving the woods until they had their boy.
But unfortunately, the end of day two ended much like the previous day, with no leads, nothing to bring them any closer to finding the boy.
On the morning of Wednesday, October 9th, Washington County Prosecutor John Rupp arrived at the firehouse to take the lead on the case.
He hurried through a wall of reporters as he made his way inside.
Rupp later described the scene, quote, "Rows of folding tables filled one bay of the firehouse, their tops covered with half-empty styrofoam coffee cups. Maps of Washington County, divided into grids, were tacked to the walls. An FBI agent, a couple of Missouri Highway Patrol officers and sheriff's deputies were working the phones, and others were delegating duties to tired but determined volunteers."
For the last 3 days, volunteers and officials didn't have much more than sheer hope to keep them moving forward. But as soon as John Rupp joined the investigation, the case received a lead.
An anonymous tipster had called the police to report that four suspects, apparently high on meth, had been careening down Highway A in a beat-up red car, struck a boy, then threw his injured body into the car. The tipster said that they took the boy to a secluded spot and shot him, then dumped his body down a dried-up well.
Investigators knew it was likely a prank or someone who just wanted to feel involved. How else would they know the boy was shot at a secondary location? But being that it was their only lead, they had to follow up. Rupp paced nervously.
Police were almost disappointed to find that the tipster's information led them straight to a red car. They walked around it. One officer stopped short when he saw the bumper. It was dented and spattered with blood and hair.
The car was immediately impounded for analysis. Investigators held their breath, waiting for results. Either it was Sean's DNA, and the Akers family would at least have some closure, or it wasn't, and secretly, Rupp hoped the latter to be true.
The car was traced to a Washington County woman, and she was questioned by police. But she claimed to have hit a dog and had no knowledge of the missing boy. And somewhat thankfully, the DNA from the blood and hair backed up her story.
Investigators breathed a sigh of relief. They had no leads and were running out of woods to search. But Sean may still be alive.
However, by Wednesday evening, volunteers were exhausted and finding it hard to shake the thought that if Sean was in the woods, the likelihood that he was still alive would be very small.
That night, as reality sunk in, the Richwoods Fire Department and Washington County Sheriff's Department made the difficult decision to halt the volunteer search mission. Fire Chief Rose Hoffman and Sheriff's Deputy Jim Nichols explained to volunteers and the media that they had done all they could to search for Sean. They covered every inch within a 20-mile radius of Richwoods three times or more, and sadly, Sean was nowhere to be found.
At this point, an abduction was highly suspected. Local police and fire officials were then instructed by FBI investigators to switch focus from a search and rescue mission to a criminal abduction investigation. They handed control over to larger law enforcement agencies like the Missouri State Police and the FBI. This is standard practice in scenarios wherein a child has been abducted or declared missing under mysterious circumstances, according to the FBI's Child Abduction Response Plan.
Craig Akers was at least glad to know that the resources of the Missouri State Police and the FBI could accelerate the investigation. However, this by no means meant that Craig Akers would give up the search on his own.
That same day, the Akers family launched the internet site SeanHornbeck.com. The site was designed to be proactive and reach as wide an audience as possible. It featured printable missing posters, pictures of Sean, a description of the boy and what happened to him, law enforcement contact information, as well as a sobering to the second update of how long it had been since Sean's disappearance. With the website, Craig Akers was only getting started.
Thursday, October 10th, was gloomy. The weather seemed to mimic the dark, cold helplessness that had gripped the town of Richwoods.
Though volunteer efforts had been officially called off and spirits were waning, two new command centers popped up that day. One headquartered at the Richwoods Fire Station and led by the FBI and Missouri State Highway Patrol Drug and Crime Division, and another at the Book of Acts Methodist Church, led by Pam and Craig Akers.
The Akers family named their command post the Sean Hornbeck Search and Rescue Team, and welcomed any volunteer who still remained dedicated to the search.
Unfortunately, volunteer numbers had already dwindled from about 200 at the beginning of the week to just 30 by the time the efforts moved to the church.
Pam and Craig Akers attempted to increase volunteer support by reaching out to the public through television and radio appearances and the website they created in their son's name. "It's a race against the clock at this point," Craig Akers told the Associated Press. "We've got to cover areas that need to be covered before the rain sets in."
Though with minuscule volunteer numbers and many news stations moving on to other stories, it felt, to the Akers family, like the nation was giving up on them.
Then, like an answer to their prayers, investigators were contacted by a psychic that evening with supposed information about the boy's disappearance. The psychic claimed that Sean's body was buried by a motorist that struck him. She then directed investigators to a wooden ravine along Highway 47, approximately a mile from where Sean was last seen.
Even though the information was hard to hear, everyone involved in the investigation welcomed answers, some sort of closure.
At the scene, skid marks and bicycle parts were found on the road and in the adjacent ravine. But after a thorough investigation, the lead was debunked. A motorist had lost control of a motorcycle Sunday evening, but law enforcement concluded that the incident was not related to the disappearance of Sean Hornbeck.
4 days into the search, the Akers family was still no closer to finding Sean than they were the evening he didn't come home.
But Pam and Craig Akers never gave up hope. Each false lead and every fruitless search only served to strengthen their resolve. They would never stop searching until their son was home safe.
In a moment, Sean's terrifying journey to the place of his captivity. Now, back to the story.
October 6, 2002. Sean had been abducted on the side of the road, tied up with duct tape, and thrown into a truck by a behemoth of a man that Sean kept silently calling the Monster. He sat slumped over sideways, bound and gagged in the passenger seat of the Monster's pickup truck.
It seemed like they drove for hours. Sean had no idea where he was being taken. He didn't dare move or look out the window. A 9mm handgun was still staring him in the face.
Terrified, Sean tried to calm himself by thinking of his family, his mom and stepdad. He hoped they would realize he was gone soon and come looking for him, the second they found his beat-up bike.
But his heart sank. He remembered that the Monster had thrown Sean's bike in the back of the truck bed. No sign of Sean had been left at the scene. As the clock in the car ticked to 5 p.m., he started to cry. He knew his mother would be worried soon.
From his strained vantage point, Sean watched as the tops of passing trees turned to gray buildings. They were in a city somewhere.
Tears streamed down Sean's face. He wondered if he'd ever see his parents again.
The truck turned into a rundown red brick apartment complex.
Sean's head banged repeatedly against the passenger side window as the truck bounced up and down over a pitted parking lot dotted with overflowing dumpsters before finally coming to a stop.
After they parked, the monster stowed the pistol in the waist of his pants, and Sean sat up a little to get a better look out the window. The red brick apartment complex was one of many in a cluster of identical derelict dumps situated between two sets of railroad tracks.
The buildings were set in rows, lining a small patch of dying grass, littered with trash and children's bicycles, serving as a courtyard. Many of the apartment units had screened doors with broken handles. Dying houseplants drooped over cluttered balconies.
This place was a far cry from the lush, green neighborhoods in Richwoods. Sean hated it here. It smelled like mold and sewage. Sean didn't know it yet, but this dump was about to become his new home.
The monster hastily got out of the truck and took a look around him, patting the gun at his waist to ensure it was concealed, just in case anyone was watching. When he was satisfied that the coast was clear, the monster quickly made his way to the passenger side of the truck. He pulled a knife from his pocket and flung Sean's door open.
The man then grabbed Sean's bound legs, flicked open his pocket knife, and cut off the duct tape.
Once the boy's legs were free, the monster stowed the knife back in his pocket and drew his pistol. He pointed it at the boy as he lifted him onto his feet and slammed the door.
"Move," the monster whispered as he pressed the barrel of the gun to the back of Sean's head. The large man then shoved the boy in the direction of his apartment and quickly opened the door.
A ripe, musty odor hit Sean as he stepped through the doorway. The apartment was a nauseating sight.
Chipped paint and dark stains covered the ceiling and walls. Old takeout containers, receipts, soda bottles, and trash littered the dingy brown carpet and every other noticeable surface. The place had minimal furniture, a futon, and a moderately sized TV set with a video game console and surprisingly large selection of video games.
A small sense of comfort washed over Sean when he noticed the video games, but it was short-lived. The monstrous man then shoved the boy through the open door and kicked it shut behind them.
"Get on the couch," the man demanded. "Stop crying and move," he bellowed. Shaking, Sean tried as hard as he could to stifle his sobs. He glanced over his shoulder at the monster with the gun and moved toward the futon.
Suddenly, the monster shoved the boy. With hands still bound, he couldn't catch his balance, and Sean stumbled over his own feet, crashing face first into the dirty couch. Sean was raped repeatedly that night. Sickeningly, the monster, who Sean would later come to know as Michael Devlin, even took photographs of the boy while he assaulted him.
Later that night, Michael Devlin resecured the bindings on the boy's hands, feet, and mouth, then pressed the muzzle of his gun against Sean's temple and whispered a promise into its ear. If he ever tried to escape or tell anyone what was done to him, he would kill Sean and his entire family.
Sean was made this promise every night during the initial few weeks as the man's prisoner. A psychotic bedtime story repeated just before Devlin tucked the bound and gagged little boy into bed next to him. Devlin then tied one end of a rope around Sean's waist and the other end around his own, just to be sure that the boy would remain close.
Many nights, the monster woke Sean up every 45 minutes throughout the night, a tactic usually reserved for prisoners of war, to break them down cognitively and make them less defensive in order to extract information.
And each morning, before leaving for work, the monster untied the boy from his waist, dragged him to the living room, and retied him to the futon so he couldn't escape while the monster was away. The monster frequently came home on his lunch break to allow the boy to eat or to go to the bathroom, but for the most part, Sean remained tied to that couch.
Soon, Michael Devlin was the only human contact that Sean had and controlled when or if Sean ate, slept, or used the facilities. Whether knowingly or not, Devlin was creating an environment in which Sean was fully dependent on him for his most basic living functions.
Dr. Frank Ockberg, a psychiatrist who advised the FBI and Scotland Yard in hostage situations during the 1970s, said that, quote, small acts of kindness, such as being given food after a prolonged traumatic experience and denial of the most basic needs, prompts a primitive gratitude for the gift of life, end quote. In other words, because of this forced dependence, Sean slowly began relying on Devlin for everything and trusting him implicitly.
Over time, Devlin didn't need to use the gun or the restraints on the boy anymore. He wasn't going anywhere. The boy was reprogrammed. Michael Devlin was in complete control.
One night, a few weeks into Sean's capture, Devlin came home to find Sean sitting on the futon, quietly playing video games.
The boy had been in the apartment all day by himself, no longer in his restraints. He never tried to run.
The monster stared at the boy hunched over on the futon, holding a game controller. His eyes, once so filled with life, were completely empty. Devlin frowned. That morning, he had seen Sean as a fun little pet. Now, he saw him for what he really was. Boring.
Devlin retrieved his gun and pressed the barrel against Sean's forehead. The boy didn't even flinch.
Get up, he growled as he cocked the gun. Then he heaved the boy up by his collar and forced him out of the apartment, slamming the door behind them.
With the gun still pointed at Sean, the monster hurled the boy into the passenger seat of his beat-up white truck.
They drove for a little less than an hour. The trees looked familiar, so Sean thought for an instant that maybe the monster had decided to take him back home. But that couldn't have been further from the truth.
Sweat began to bead on Devlin's face, and his expression grew more and more conflicted, angry and desperate. He finally stopped the car somewhere deep in the woods of Washington County.
Sean was worried. The monster had never taken him out of the apartment.
But Devlin didn't notice the concern crossing Sean's face. He was too deep in thought, pondering how to do it. He could shoot the kid, but that would be messy.
He looked over to Sean and saw fear filling his eyes. He liked that.
Finally, Devlin seemed to decide on something. He pulled a roll of duct tape out from under his seat.
He got out of the truck and walked over to the passenger side, threw open the door, and grabbed both of Sean's arms, pulling the boy toward him.
The monster then bound Sean's hands and covered his mouth with the duct tape before tossing him into the dirt.
Sean tried to crawl away, terrified.
Devlin clamped his giant hands around the boy's tiny neck and, with a crazed expression in his eyes, lifted Sean off the ground and began strangling him.
Sean kicked as he felt the air leaving his body, tears trickling from his eyes. He could feel himself blacking out and wondered if the monster's face would be the last thing he saw. Then everything went dark.
Next week, we'll rejoin Sean's parents in the search for their son and detail how a lead on Michael Devlin's next victim, Ben Ownby, led to a major break in the Sean Hornbeck case. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Courtney Rosaire, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.